Welcome back to the Dunked On Basketball Podcast, April 21st, the night of April 21st edition. We got three games to talk about. We'll get right to it with Danny, who watched this game a little more closely than I did since I was at work and didn't get back until the fourth quarter. Cavs beat the Celtics 99-91. What struck you about this game, Danny?
What struck me was that in the early part of the game, the Celtics starting lineup that we criticized a little bit before did pretty well. It had a nice little start, but then it was unsustainable. And the other kind of big takeaway for me beyond the Cavs being the Cavs was Tristan Thompson had a pretty notable positive impact in the game because of his rebounding, particularly his offensive rebounding. And when I was thinking about it, that was one of my takeaways, and I didn't look at the box score until hours later, noticing that he didn't even have a shot attempt in the game. And so it was another example of how a player can make a difference in the outcome of the game without doing the traditional things.
Yeah, Mozgov also had four offensive rebounds, and it seemed like every time the Cavs were sort of having a stagnant possession in the fourth quarter, that those two guys would get an offensive rebound dribbled out, and they are able to bleed the clock out. And so, I mean, the Celtics defended pretty well in this game, frankly. To hold the Cavs to 99 points, I think, is about as much as you might expect from them. They're a relatively defensively challenged team. So I thought their D was pretty good. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I agree with that. The other amazing thing about this game is that Boston shot 86% from the line. They went 19-22. And the Cavs made more free throws at a better rate because the Cavs were 24-26, which is absolutely incredible.
Another thing that we got to note here is Kevin Love only played about 30 minutes, did not close the game. As it turned out, the Celtics really kept it close, within two or four throughout much of the fourth quarter, but then Cleveland was able to pull away towards the end. But that's going to be something to watch. I mean, there's always this undercurrent of whether Love is going to leave or not, and if he's not closing the games. I mean, he did have one sweet reverse dunk, but, only 13 points in 30 minutes. Not a huge impact on the boards. He doesn't really pass the ball that much anymore either. I think that maybe is his biggest difference from his Minnesota days, is that he used to be one of the best passing bigs, and that's not something that Cleveland has really featured. So, again, we've talked about this before, how every player sort of wants to feel self-actualization, and some of them come to the realization that they're just role players and, they need to play a role, and that's how they're going to be on a winning team. But other guys like Love, I mean, if you've averaged 26-12 in this league, you want to feel like you can do that and you feel like you can win at the same time. So, just something to watch, not hitting the panic button, blah, blah. Let's wait till they lose a playoff game first before we do that with regard to Love leaving. But again, something to monitor in a slight bit.
Yeah, I agree with all that. And a big change with him is where he gets his touches. I mean, when he was on Minnesota, he would get a lot of them near the paint, and he would have enough time to be able to make a move himself or be able to make a pass. And what also has to be frustrating for Love is, yeah, those Minnesota teams weren't great, but they had obvious flaws that were unrelated to him. I mean, they never really had a true rim-protecting center, and their perimeter players generally didn't stay healthy. So he can be walking around with the feeling that I could be a huge part of a great team, as opposed to being satisfied with being a small part of a big team.
One last question I had. We were a little critical of Brad Stevens for playing Evan Turner so much at the expense of Jay Crowder. We thought Crowder did a much better job on LeBron. This game, Turner, 3 of 11, didn't hit a three, but he did have 12 rebounds, 9 points overall. But he was +8 in a game that they lost by 8, and he played 33 minutes. So what do you think? Did he play well? Was Stevens right to play him so much? Should he have gone to Crowder anyway? Is that +8 misleading? What did you take away from his performance?
I think the +8 is somewhat misleading. I think how that happened was there was one of those big Cavs runs, because they had, I think, three big runs, and one of them he wasn't out on the court when Marcus Smart and Avery Bradley were. So I think it's more that. But he was all right. I mean, early on in the game, it was actually surprising that it took LeBron a little while to get going. So some of that goes to Evan Turner. I don't think he gets most of the credit for that. But I still don't think that against this specific Cavs team, I don't think Evan Turner is a huge part of any success that they have. And he has some downside potential just because they're asking him to do something really hard. In another series, that could be more positive. But I didn't see even though he had the best plus minus of the starters and the second best to Kelly Olynyk, who should have played more with the starters anyway, that I don't think it was that as much as it was just the way that the minutes broke down.
Tufa Mozgov deserves some discussion here. 7 of 11 from the field, 7 rebounds, 4 on the offensive glass, as we mentioned, plus 17 in his 28 minutes. We talked about that Thompson might be better as a matchup at center, but Mozgov was pretty good. And he's someone who can match up with Tyler Zeller, who played 30 minutes in this game. It's really, I still maintain that Boston's best chance is going to be to go small with Olynyk at the 5, and not necessarily small, but just with better shooting, Olynyk at the 5 and Jarebko at the 4. He only played 4 minutes in this game. Was he ineffective? Why do you think he played so little?
I'm a little bit baffled by Stevens's rotations. That might have been injury-related. I'm honestly not sure. It was such a small amount considering how well he played in game 1 that it was jarring to me. I didn't hear anything like that, but it's possible I missed it. But I'm not as sold on you as Jarebko as the 4 in those circumstances, but Olynyk has been, I would say, the brightest spot for them in terms of the ways to theoretically beat the Cavs. So I'm really on board with you there.
Yeah, Olynyk was plus 13 tonight, although he didn't really shoot the ball well. Again, you know, you never know a lot of times, especially since I didn't watch that much of the game, how much of that plus minus was just noise and how much of it was him actually playing well when he didn't have a great box score stat line. Jared Sullinger also played 22 minutes and he had 14 points on 6 made field goals, 12 field goal attempts. But I really don't like him much as a matchup in this series. He's just not going to be able to protect the rim, and he can't move either. At least Olynyk can move a little bit in pick and roll. He could potentially credibly switch on to guys, you know, especially if it's not LeBron. So in the late clock, at least, not something he'd be amazing at. Again, none of these guys are amazing defensively. But he can at least space the floor a little more, and I think that would be the way to go. Again, you know, I still think Thomas should start. He played only 30 minutes in this game. Had more turnovers than you'd like, but still, it's really hard to see how this team is going to score. I mean, it's tough, you know. Like, they really have, if you look at it, one above-average individual offensive player, and it's him. So they still score pretty well when you consider all that, but I think they need to space the floor a little better and see what they can do, because they're not stopping this team anyway, regardless.
Agreed. You want to move on to the next game?
Yeah, really a depressing outing from the Raptors in this game. They got blown out by the Wizards, got within 11 at the end, pretty unrelated to how the game actually went. You know, through the middle two quarters, the Wizards scored 34 and 37 points, respectively, and just killed the Raptors in those quarters. I mean, there's just no excuse for giving up a buck 17 to this Wizards team. I mean, they were hitting every shot, to be sure, and John Wall was unbelievable. He had 26 points and 17 assists. Although he did have 5 turnovers, you had always mentioned that, Callum. But yeah, I mean, it was an amazing performance for Washington, and the Raptors just couldn't stop it. And they lost Kyle Lowry to a shin contusion as well at the end of the game. So looking pretty terrible for them. Only one team, I think, in the last 10 years, Houston in 2005, has lost the first two at home and then gone on to win the series. So, I mean, we could probably declare this one all but over, I'm afraid.
Yeah, I do feel like there's a distinct chance, as somebody who followed the Wizards for a lot of the 2015 season so far, there's a distinct chance that they lose at least one of the two games at home. But even then, this Toronto team just got worked in this game. I mean, it was amazing that it took the Wizards kind of having a fourth quarter without a lot of stakes for their shooting percentage to drop down to the low 50s. I believe they were at near 60% at some point in the third quarter when they were just getting everything. And one guy that I want to single out, both for his stat line but also just for the way he played, is Otto Porter. Otto Porter has had a rough go of it. He's a guy that, you know, he was a high pick. A lot of good players went after him. But he was the 3 that made a lot of this work. And another thing that I really wanted to talk with you about is, Paul Pierce at the 4 was one of the catalysts that made this work so well for Washington. And at one point, Dwayne Casey brought in James Johnson, who is, I think, their best defender, kind of for that type of player. and he didn't put Johnson on Paul Pierce. It was beyond dumbfounding.
You know, I disagree with you on that. I know that Zach Lowe tweeted that out as well. And Paul Pierce didn't really do anything in this game, right? I mean, it's not like he was lighting up. He had 7 points, had a couple of threes, but I think he was 1 of 5 at halftime. That, for those who didn't catch the game, the Wizards made a big run in the end of the second quarter to go up and score 60 points by halftime. And that small lineup was effective. But I think I understand the idea of putting Johnson on somebody else because he's someone who's a pretty good help defender, even as a four. He's got a lot of energy, blocks a lot of shots. You know, at least physically he is. He's not someone who is necessarily the most intelligent. But we said in our wrap-up of the first game that you want to make Otto Porter make some more shots. He did that a little bit tonight. He made 6 of his 8 shots and had 15 points. But I understand the thinking. You want to get someone who can help at the basket. You don't want to put one of your second-best help defender in that lineup on Pierce and then have him glued to him at the three-point line while everyone else operates. So I get it. I mean, I see the argument for having him on Pierce as well, but it wasn't nearly as egregious to me as it was to everyone else who was watching.
Okay, I can get that. That's fair.
Do you think I'm wrong? What am I missing here?
I mean, I think that when you're talking about where the players are on the floor, when you're talking Paul Pierce versus Otto Porter, I don't think that it's not like you're putting him against, let's say, like Sean Livingston or somebody who's playing more in the interior. Porter isn't camped in the same way that Paul Pierce is. I think that Porter's more active in that way, but I don't think of it. I think it's a little bit more nuanced, but I do understand. And also, James Johnson only played 7 minutes, so it's not like it was this long running thing of, oh my god, he did this the entire game. Jim Johnson only played 7 minutes.
So this is what I don't necessarily understand about that.
Okay.
You know, in the first game, we were saying, all right, you know, you should have put Patrick Patterson or whoever the other big was. If you're not going to downgrade or downmatch with them, you put whoever the other big was on Otto Porter. All right, so now you're bringing James Johnson in essentially as the four, so why are you not going to put him on Otto Porter? I mean, I think it's a little logically inconsistent to say those two things. Now, James is much better at locking down individually on Pierce, but Pierce wasn't necessarily the problem individually in this game. So I think that might be going a little bit too far to say that it's inexplicable. I can certainly understand how you disagree, but this is not one of the more puzzling coaching moves that we've seen over the first few games, at least in my eyes.
Okay, I'll agree I overstated it.
Well, you weren't the only one. I mean, I think I'm more outside of the mainstream here than you are on this one, so a reasonable position.
But either way, I'll say that I overstated it.
Fair enough. I think really a couple other points here. The first one is, what would have happened in this series without foul trouble for Kyle Lowry? He missed, I think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong here, he missed most of the end of that run at the end of the second quarter due to foul trouble, fouled out at the end of game one in a game that went into overtime. Maybe he would have made the difference there too. So if he's not in foul trouble, maybe this is a 1-1 series. Maybe they even are able to keep it a little more competitive in this game, although it's hard to say that when they lost by 20. But in Lowry's minutes, they still were somehow +9 despite losing by 11 and really being down by a lot more than that throughout pretty much the entire second half. So maybe things would have been different with Lowry, even though people are saying, oh, he was only 3 out of 10. He still is one of their only guy who can really defend at an above average level when he's locked in on the perimeter, at least among that starting guard group. So maybe things would be different if he had played.
I definitely think they would be different. And when you're talking about that, yeah, Lowry was only 3-10. Also, John Wall had John Wall's game. We already talked about it. And Beal had a good game. And I think having Lowry out there definitely helps that. And, yeah, I mean, you talked about the role of him as being a defender on the perimeter. And the perimeter guys from Washington, not only were they getting points for themselves, but they were helping generate looks for one another. And when you're replacing those Lowry minutes with Grievous Vasquez, who had a lot of trouble in this game, and Lou Williams, who, while he has plenty of strengths, he just won Sixth Man of the Year. Congratulations to him for that. He's not a defender. He's more of a guy who can create for his team. And when the other team is just dropping buckets in, you're not going to outscore them. But it's not like, oh, they shouldn't have played Lou Williams. It was that they didn't really have other options.
Another thing we can point to in this game was just that the Washington bigs were much better than their counterparts. It really, again, just like in game one. And we said whoever the best big was in this series, that would go a long way towards determining that. Washington's big, Gortat especially, he had 16 points, 7-9 shooting today. So he was outstanding. Dene didn't play that many minutes, but I thought that his defense has been pretty solid throughout the series as well. And Drew Gooden even has played reasonably well, at least in terms of spreading the floor, even though he hasn't hit that many shots. And then you can even throw Otto Porter or Pierce in there as a big man as well when they've been playing in small lineups, which have really broken the game open. So the production from the four or five spots has really been huge for Washington. And, of course, their guards exploded today as well. So I think now you look at the Raptors, they're probably going to get, you know, not going to be competitive in this series, especially if Lowry continues to be injured. And we don't have to talk about this now, but if you look at what their future is going to hold, it's already a little dicey. Amir Johnson, free agent, and they have some other decisions to make. Lou Williams, a free agent. So they're going to have to decide now. And Jonas Valanciunas is up for a potential rookie extension. So Masai Ujiri is going to have to make the decision. He could have cap space this summer. Do you reload? Do you totally rebuild? Do you still try to build around this core more and re-sign everyone? I think, you know, the worse they do in this series, the more they skew towards rebuilding.
Yeah, I definitely agree that it has that that process. And the other kind of thing about them that's so fascinating is that they did these kind of short extensions for role players last summer. And though Grievous Vasquez and Patrick Patterson are going to make a little over $12.5 million next year, and they're both good players, but even if you ask Patterson to start, let's say Amir leaves, I couldn't shake the feeling then, and I can't shake it now, that they could do something. They could have had the ability to do something greater, but instead they still have options. But I don't know. I've fixated on that since they made those moves last summer.
Yeah, by the way, America, or at least the small portion of it that listens to this podcast, just got introduced to my cat, if you hear the meowing in the background. So hopefully he will be a integral part of this podcast team moving forward. Let's move on to Dallas and Houston. And I thought this was really the main event, as the Western Conference tends to be. 111-99 Rockets victory. Pretty dispiriting for the Mavericks, wouldn't you say?
Very good word choice. What I wanted to start with this is that you and I talked after game one that you hadn't seen a ton of it, and people, including myself, had talked about how good Dwight Howard looked. What did you think of him, this really being your first chance to see him in the playoffs?
Oh, yeah, he was fantastic. And it even made me think of a potential theory, which I'm just throwing out there. I don't know whether I believe it or not, which is that athletic guys are more likely to up their playoff performance, whereas less athletic guys maybe have struggled more to up their playoff performance. I think Blake Griffin, Derrick Rose, and then, of course, Howard are all guys who've been able to do that, whereas, you know, you see some guys like, say, Dirk, who has struggled to do that in the last few years as he's lost athleticism. I think Dirk is kind of the place to start, though, for the Mavericks, because I had this inkling that was growing throughout the year that Dirk might kind of be done as really a player who can be a starter on a championship team. And that's really harsh to say. It's taken me a long while to get there, but I think it's just he's at the point now where it's nearly impossible for you to have a good defense. I mean, you saw what Josh Smith did to them. Dirk was guarding him nearly that entire time. They would just run 2-4 pick and roll. You can't switch that and put Dirk onto Harden. And then Josh Smith was getting loose. They tried to hedge out on Harden, and then it put Tyson Chandler in a bind where he had to either get out onto Smith or get the lob to Howard. Steve Smith, who did a great job along with Brian Anderson in this game, I really enjoyed that combo doing the game for TNT, said he felt sorry for Chandler, and I totally agree. I think you talked about that with Seth Partno on your podcast about a week ago. So that was pretty ugly. They also had a lot of success running 4-5 pick and roll, a play called elbow get, which can lead to a lot of, if you switch it, then it's Howard posting up Nowitzki. If you don't switch it, then you get the lob to Howard as well, or you get Smith turning the corner. And Dallas just had no answer for any of that stuff. And unfortunately, a lot of it started with Dirk's defense.
Yeah, you saw so much of that 2-4 pick and roll and the carnage that can come from that. And what I kept on thinking about, and it's a small frivolous point, but Josh Smith and Dwight Howard played AAU ball together on the Atlanta Celtics years ago, which is also kind of funny because Josh Smith played high school ball with Rajon Rondo, which is the other kind of long-term story that was a part of this game.
Well, long-term, maybe about 2 more games worth of story.
Yeah, but at this rate, frankly.
But
how it affects his value moving forward, that if there's a playoff team that is choosing to play Raymond Felton over this guy and he's going to hit the open market, I think that has to give teams pause.
My buddy Fred Katz, great writer for Bleacher Report and Fox Sports, asked me today, if you could get Rajon Rondo on a minimum contract, but you had to have him as your starting point guard next year, would you do it?
Ooh. Oh, I hate to give the lawyer answer, but it depends. It depends on what you have. But I would, if you have to give him starter minutes, you know, if you have to go 30-plus, I would be very hesitant. If you could do, I mean, obviously we're not going to cheat and do the Keith Bogans Memorial starting spot.
But yeah, yeah, you got to play him starter's minutes, obviously, under this construct.
So, yeah, if you have to play him 28-plus, it'd be a hard sell for me, honestly. It'd be a hard sell. But I still think somebody's going to do it, and I think somebody's going to pay him a lot of money to do it.
Yeah, no, it'll be real interesting what happens with him. But and I think some measure of schadenfreude for those who said, look, they're ruining their team by getting this guy. And obviously there's a lot more to it than that, but they sure miss Jay Crowder in this series. They sure miss Brandon Wright. He was so key, his working with Dirk and being able to finish alley-oops on the second unit. Amari Stoudemire, while he's a decent offensive player, doesn't quite provide that. He doesn't provide the shot blocking that Wright had either. So, I mean, they miss those guys, and there's a reason that they cratered as soon as they traded away all of them. I still think it was a worthy gamble in some respects because their defense wasn't good enough. Maybe there was some chance that Rondo could get back to the level that he was at, and although I think where he was at was always a little bit overrated as well. But, you know, I understand why they did it, even though you can even argue that it wasn't necessarily more likely than not to work out well. You're at least potentially giving yourself a higher ceiling. So I see that. And, you know, he's a free agent. You can always move on from him. Sadly, they had to give up some assets for him. The thing about Dallas that struck me in this game, and Houston played a great game. Let's not lose that. And Howard was fantastic. As you noted, looked really athletic. But who on this Dallas team is a two-way player? They have one two-way player, really, on the whole team. And then Parsons and Harris weren't playing. So, and those, you know, you would say those guys are closest among the remaining guys to being a two-way player. Tyson Chandler is the only two-way guy on that whole team. So, you know, I really, and like, at one point in the fourth quarter, it was Barea and Monte Ellis and Raymond Felton and Dirk and Tyson Chandler. I mean, that's just like a joke lineup. Like, it's, and I'm not saying Carlisle should have done something different. He was trying to push the buttons and get what he could, but that's not a lineup that's going to win a game in the playoffs. Like, I'm sorry, it's just not.
The way I was thinking about a similar issue, but I phrase it a little bit differently, is one of the questions that I ask when I'm evaluating teams and when I'm evaluating players is, could they be a capable starter on a team that makes the conference finals? I think that's a fair level to assess a player. And when I was watching this Mavericks team, the only guy I really thought of was Tyson Chandler, and he was having a lot of trouble, but I don't think most of that was his fault. And Dirk was having a lot of trouble. Rajon Rondo, Monte, I've been critical of Monte for years. I defended him a little while, but I've been critical of him for years. And so I'll ask you, for me, I only saw one guy on the floor for the Mavericks tonight who I think is a starter on a conference finals team. How many did you see?
And who would that have been? Chandler?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, especially the way Dirk shot the ball. I think he was 3 out of 14. The problem, too, with him is Houston just switched everything. And Dirk, even when he was matched up on, like, Pablo Prigioni at the free throw line, he has zero ability to get by guys anymore now. And so it's just a fadeaway 1-2, and he doesn't quite seem to have his legs under him, even when he's shooting a set shot. He's never had like the most unbelievable mechanics, but he was kind of not really landing in the same place, you know, kind of flailing out awkwardly a little bit, and just everything kind of looked off about him, and his body doesn't quite look right. And, you know, hopefully we'll find out that there's something going on with him, and he can be better next year. But if this is what he is now, it really might be the end of him as a high-level starter on a championship team. I mean, not to even mention a superstar.
The coincidence of all coincidences for me, considering the games that happened today, is that it feels like his role on Dallas could end up being something similar offensively to what Kevin Love is stuck doing in Cleveland.
Yeah, that, I think you might be right about that, and that's fine. But, you know, Love is a much better defender than Dirk is at this point. And if Dirk's role is just going to be to stand out there at the three-point line and shoot, and he's not going to be able to be that effective in pick and pops because they're just going to switch and he can't make them pay for that, then his defense becomes a lot less tolerable if you're not just killing everybody and offensively as well. So, you know, it's going to be tough for them. What any other takeaways? Who else do you think played well or had a notable performance in this game?
I thought we talked a little bit about, I thought Josh Smith had some really great stretches. We lose sight sometimes of how talented a player is. Yeah, he had this moment at one point where he shot two threes, one of which was when the shot clock was expiring, so that's all right. But the other one was pretty bad. And then the next play down, he somehow simultaneously saved the ball while falling out of bounds and passed it to a open but still seemingly impossible to see Corey Brewer, who drilled the three when the game was still, you know, it was still close-ish. And to me, it kind of represented both sides of Josh Smith. It's that you have these negatives to him, but that he can pull some positives out of his hat that very few guys of his size can really do, and his passing is incredibly underrated. The alley-oops to Dwight are one thing, but I thought that the other movements that he made were really impressive.
Yeah, he was outstanding, and we need to give him credit. He's someone who, you know, frankly, has been a whipping boy for a lot of people, and he had a great game. It was really good to see. So a couple more thoughts that I had. I thought Al-Farouq Aminu was excellent in this game.
Yes.
He looked really athletic. They play him mostly now at the four, or sometimes even at the five, although I don't think they've done that at all in this series. But he's a guy who is available for free, and as long as he's playing the four, he's someone who could be a pretty solid free agent this year and maybe get brought in as a four, someone who can switch on to smaller players. Maybe you hope that you can get his three-point shooting up to sort of passable levels, someone like he could be more of a poor man, Draymond Green, although he's got to hit the weight room. He really hasn't added any weight at all since he got into the league. But playing him at the four is really much better, especially if the other team doesn't have a post-up four. He was miscast as a three, which he mostly was when he was with the Clippers, when he was drafted. Then when he moved on to New Orleans, he was still playing in the perimeter because New Orleans just didn't have any threes. They had to find someone last year. So I think now that he's found his niche as an athletic guy who can block some shots, rebound, work in the pick and roll, and maybe hit a few threes every once in a while instead of having to space out all the time offensively, he could be very effective. He's sort of a low-budget free agent guy that you might look into if you're going to use him properly.
He's a guy who can benefit from his price point being a little bit lower, because if he was, you know, valued a couple mil higher, then the team might need to push him up in the rotation. And now, if he's more in the, maybe a little bit above the minimum, I think he's better than the minimum, then he can pick the right spot for him. And I think that's really useful because he's a talented player. I think that you talked about like kind of a poor man's Draymond Green. I think his defensive versatility can be very valuable in today's NBA. You are doing a trade-off because his offense is not there to the point that I feel like would be useful as a starter. But if he's a guy who can be, let's say, your seventh or eighth guy off the bench, and who maybe you move him in with some of the starters because generally they're more offensively capable, I think that you could be very happy with him. I think that he can be a very useful part of a good team.
Another thing we should note, though, is that Dallas's defense in the second half was pretty miserable outside of just the Dirk problem. Monte Ellis, he was miscast trying to guard Harden most of the time once they took Rondo out. I mean, I think Carlisle almost thought that Rondo getting his fourth foul was a blessing so he could get him out of there. He took him out with two fouls in the first quarter, in the first half. So I thought he liked that, but then, you know, Ellis had to guard Harden, and then he also had to guard Corey Brewer. And Corey Brewer, I think Corey Brewer is a very good litmus test for your defense. If Corey Brewer is scoring a lot of points, you're just not doing a good enough job of getting back. You're not doing a good enough job guarding basic actions and preventing cuts. I mean, he had two back cuts in a row on Monte Ellis. The second one, Ellis was just nailed to the floor about 18 feet from the basket in the corner while Brewer back cut him from the corner and laid it in. And it was really just one of the worst instances of defense you're going to see over the entire course of an NBA season. So that was really bad. I know you're not a fan of Ellis's defense, and that's one of the reasons why. But again, it mostly comes down to personnel, not only mentally, but just they don't have it. You had a lot of guys who were playing for the Mavericks who are barely rotation players. I mean, Charlie V, a guy who's kind of a scrappy guy, same thing with Richard Jefferson. Those guys were getting minutes. And with Parsons out, with Harris out, I mean, I just don't think it's realistic to expect this Mavericks team to do that well. I thought they fought gamely overall, but you have to imagine the series is done in about five unless Parsons can somehow come back and be 100%, which seems rather unlikely at this point.
As well as the Rockets have played, and they've played very well, especially Dwight has been encouraging, do you feel like they're really... How dangerous, I guess, is better than... Or do you feel they're dangerous against the winner of the Clippers-Spurs series?
That's an interesting question, and one of the things I'm thinking about that is the Rockets now are the latest team. We've seen just a ton of teams now try to have some success, really, with switching. And switching works much better than it did in bygone days in the NBA because it used to be you had to either hard double team to help someone or you just couldn't help at all. Now you can switch and now you can really help and still get back to your man, help and recover much more easily than you could under the old rules. So switching is much more viable because of the way you can give help. And teams who move the ball, especially whether it's the Spurs, whether it's Atlanta, even Golden State to some degree, that don't have necessarily unbelievable offensive talents, but have succeeded in setting screens and moving the ball and getting their offense that way, spreading the floor with shooting, maybe that becomes a lot less effective now. Maybe the league is going to, the teams that can really communicate and switch and have guys who are of like size can stymie those teams, and maybe we'll see a little bit of a switch back to teams that have better isolation players because they can still beat that switching strategy, and you can't do it against a team like, say, Cleveland. Against Houston, you probably can't really do it. You don't want to get a big switch on Harden. He's too good in isolation for that, I think, most of the time, especially if he's got more time. So, you know, that'll be an interesting contrast of strategies. I do think that Houston's offense can get a little bit stagnant, especially in the third quarter when Harden was out there. He was just missing a lot of step backs. I think against real good defense, that's still going to be a struggle for him. So it'll be a contrast of styles, but having Dwight out there and having a defense that might be able to be, again, in the top tier is something with Ariza and with Howard. Those two guys can make up for a lot of deficiencies, and even Smith is a pretty athletic guy at the four. If they still had Beverly, I might actually be willing to put them pretty close to that tier against the Spurs or Clippers winner. But without him, I think they're down just one more defender in the backcourt. And so I would still have them as an underdog against that Spurs-Clippers winner.
Yeah, and Monta Ellis would be useful, especially. I know Terrence Jones missed some time due to an injury. He came back in the game. I don't know if it's going to linger. I haven't heard any reports yet.
Yeah, I think they just said he had a bloody nose. That was pretty much it. Which hopefully that diagnosis holds. But good. Yeah, I think he should be fine is what the indications are.
Were you surprised at all? I was that Capella played 10 minutes and Joey Dorsey only played one.
Not really. Capella's been pretty good lately. And
my boy,
Capella's weakness, as we've talked about before, is that he's not strong enough. But there's not necessarily anyone on Dallas who's going to punish that. If he's going up against Chandler, Chandler's not going to post up. Probably don't want Capella guarding someone like Stoudemire. I think they protected him from that matchup in large part. He mostly went against Chandler. So, no, I think Capella's been good. He's a little bit more mobile than Dorsey. He obviously can catch and finish a lot better, and he's looked pretty good. So maybe score one for the advanced analytics. I thought that Capella didn't look that good when I saw him at the 2014 Hoop Summit and the 2013 Euro Camp, but he was a darling of the advanced statistics, and the fact that he's getting even a single minute on a playoff team probably makes him a solid bet with the 25th pick in the first round, that's for sure.
Yeah, I was high on him. I like for me, I'm just one somebody who likes a big man who can block shots and rebound. It's a very simple thing, but it's just something that I value, and I think that Capella looked like a guy, both from the limited amounts I got to see of him and from the stat lines, that he was going to be able to do that, and so far, so good in the strangest of all sample sizes.
All right, one last question here before we go. Which of the teams that is currently down in the series, outside of the Spurs-Clippers series, has the best chance, and do any of them really have any chance?
I would say the best chance is Toronto, just because the Wizards are so inconsistent and because I think that their flaws are more correctable in that sense. But I don't think they have a great chance, but I would say they have the best chance. Do you agree with that?
That's a tough call. I think Portland played so poorly in that first game that it's hard to think of them. But, you know, Memphis still has their own injury issues. They got some great shooting out of Udrich and Conley. And, you know, I think Portland just had some really bad shooting out of McCollum and Lillard. If that kind of equalized a little bit more, maybe that's a closer game. And, you know, maybe Portland will get a little healthier if Aflalo can come back. Their home court is always good. So I think they might still have the best chance of any of those underdogs of making it a series. The Wizards have played much better in the playoffs on the road than at home these last couple years. Randy Whitman now 7-1 on the road as an NBA playoff coach. I think there's a lot of people who would be rather surprised at that. He certainly deserves some credit for what he's been able to get this team to do on the road. But I feel you on Washington. I think that they're somewhat of a schizophrenic team. But you know, they're also up two, and they have they have three of the next five at home still. So I guess I would go with Portland, but I mean, you know, you're really just splitting hairs at this point. I don't think either of them has much of a chance. It's too bad. It's kind of shaping up as a little bit of a somnambulant first round after that unbelievable one that we had last year.
Yeah, I agree with that, but at the same point, it could put the focus on a couple of interesting series. I think that we both expect Spurs-Clippers to go for a while, so we could be following that. And I think there's a very real chance that one other series is going to push on to at least, like, you know, six. Maybe I think it might be the Wizards-Raptors series. It'll push on. It might not be the most fun thing in the world, but at least it'll be something going on there. But yeah, I agree with you. But what I always think about, and this goes to the NCAA tournament, is oftentimes when you have a boring first round, that means you're going to have a better second and third round, because the reason that it was boring is because there was a talent disparity. And I feel you on that. I think we saw that. I think that things are lining up for a more exciting than we even hoped Bulls-Cavs series, because the Bulls are looking so much better than we thought, considering Derrick Rose's inconsistencies. And the West, I think, is a little bit more balanced. I think that the Warriors have struggled a little bit more than I expected. I don't think they're going to, you know, I don't think they're going to get a full-strength Memphis team or Portland. Definitely not full-strength Portland. And then the other series, I think, now is even more exciting than it was before because of how well Houston has played.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. Two little more nuggets that we have to wrap up a little bit. One is Nikola Mirotic's injury. Ken Berg today reported that there's no ligament damage. He does not have a concussion, but he has both a swollen knee and a quad contusion. So it's looking unlikely, I think, at this point that he'll play in Game 3. But hopefully the Bulls won't need him and they can close it out early and get some good rest. I think the greater issue is that he gets brought back too soon and never gets healthy for the Cavs series. The other thing is, we've been hearing these rumors over the last week or so. I think Woj reported it at Yahoo, and I saw it somewhere else as well, I can't recall where, that Kevin Ollie might be a candidate to replace Scott Brooks. And I've never been the biggest Scott Brooks fan. I think he's been great building a culture there. I think he has a great relationship with his players. To hear them tell it, you never know, because, you know, people aren't necessarily going to be honest about that sort of thing, but everything that we've seen indicates that he does. I think the reason you move on from Brooks is you get someone who has a proven track record at the NBA level of encouraging more ball movement and a better offensive system. I mean, that's really where Oklahoma City can improve the most. And Kevin Ollie is not that. He'd be a first-time head coach. I mean, I think he's most known is because he's so respected there when he was finishing up his career with those young guys. But I mean, what can you point to that he's going to do any better than Brooks? Brooks is already well renowned for the sort of man that he is. Maybe Brooks is unwilling to bring in another assistant, but I think that would be my first step, would be to bring in someone kind of an offensive coordinator type with Brooks and say, hey, you know, we want you to implement something that's a little more complex, as opposed to just starting over completely with Ollie, who has no track record at all, especially when next year is so incredibly important. What are your thoughts on Ollie potentially replacing Brooks if that were to happen?
I think that it's a move that's being done for something much different than X's and O's, and that is the very close relationship. Well, not very close. A lot of respect that Kevin Durant has for Kevin Ollie. And I believe there are quotes out there that Durant said that Ollie was one of the people heavily responsible for the culture that Oklahoma City has. There was some reporting out there from various outlets a couple of years ago about that. And Kevin Durant is going to be an unrestricted free agent in 2016. One of the things that you and I have talked about in various forms is that the current NBA system basically makes it functionally irresponsible for quality players to sign extensions. So what that means is that a guy like Kevin Durant is going to hit the open market whether he wants to stay or not. And I feel like what they're doing is they're giving him the pitch of this is why you should stay. Incidentally, while I think Oklahoma City could get a better coach and get success and win that way, I've been pushing for the Washington Wizards to hire Kevin Ollie for a couple of years now. It was one of those things that I thought made a lot of sense for them because they could use that relationship and they had the talent to improve anyway so they could build this narrative. Oklahoma City already has the talent. So then yeah. you're taking a huge risk because you're adding this guy. The hope is that it's on relationship and maybe the team plays well. They'll almost definitely be healthier. I hope I'm not jinxing them, but it seems hard to imagine them having worse health luck than this year. So they'll have that. But you're putting a lot of eggs in that basket because if he doesn't like it, if things don't succeed, then that I think that allows him to consider heading out with a clearer conscience.
Yeah, last point here, because I know you have to go. Appeasement of NBA stars typically has worked about as well as it did for Neville Chamberlain. You know, I mean, we've seen teams try to cater to their stars, you know, whether it was Dwight Howard, whether it was LeBron, and they end up leaving anyway. And, you know, I think you're better off just doing whatever you think will make you win the most games. And that's what gets somebody to stay. You know, so that's what I think they should do. If they think that that's Kevin Ollie, they know him. Maybe they have reason to believe he'll be better than Brooks. But if you're just thinking, all right, he has a good relationship with Durant, this will convince him to stay. Well, that relationship's not going to matter if you don't win next year.
And to think about it another way, the other example that kind of proves this is Steve Kerr. Stephen Curry had a very positive relationship, sure, by all accounts, from Mark Jackson. They thought that they could improve at coach. Shock. Of all shocks, they were able to improve on Mark Jackson as a coach. And guess what? Stephen Curry's the prohibitive favorite for MVP. He's on a team with largely the same talent that's a title contender. And I believe he is substantially more likely to stay than he was because the team is actually good. That's what matters more. LeBron didn't leave Cleveland because of the coaching all the situation. It was that they were trying to polish something up that wasn't as good as the other opportunities. And Oklahoma City doing a move like this is a worthwhile gesture, maybe, but it won't correct any structural flaws, like maybe trading an all-NBA player and MVP candidate to save money that would have made it more likely for him to stay, because it's all about the quality of the opportunity. The coach is a part of it, but not a huge part.
That's a good one to end on. Let's call it quits for today. We'll be back tomorrow. Until then.